Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, psychological health, physical health awareness in men, women and society. First, it started with MAN, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. He's told me there's not a wanted poster behind him on the wall, but I'm starting to believe that there is. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, absolutely. My name is Noah Blakesley. I am here in the United States. I live in Massachusetts. I work as a legal operations assistant at an immigration law firm in Framingham, Mass. I'm 24 years old, and I love what I do. I'm feeling very honored to be here.
Yep, and thank you for coming on the show. And I know it was quite short, didn't it? We don't know each other, and it was quite short how it's kind of come together. Was it this week? Was it? Did I message you this week? Or was it last week? And we kind of. It's been short, hasn't it? Short time.
Yeah, it's. I believe it was approximately about 4 days or so. I was sitting there in the office. It's been a very busy week. Yeah. We're doing our. We're trying to meet the quota for having all of as many immigrants come into our country as right. we possibly can right now to meet the workmanship cap for educated workers. So it was very busy, but I took a brief minute to look at my phone and I saw a message from Men Are Nuts podcast. And I've seen the show come up a few times in my feed, and I saw a message and the invitation to come on the show. And this is the first time that I have been interviewed since I have been doing my podcast. Yeah. So I feel very, very honored to be here, very happy to join the show. But it was really quick turnaround.
Yeah, because normally, I can't say normally, because sometimes I get people, it might be 2 weeks or whatever, but sometimes I've had people, you know, say, oh, I'll come on in 5 weeks' time or 2 months' time. I'm thinking, okay. Because obviously some people are busy. And then some people are kind of feeling it out and all that sort of stuff. But you're happy to be here. And what are things like at the moment for you? I mean, I'll kind of always talk about the weather. What's the weather like at the moment there?
Sure. So we actually have been in a warm spell, surprisingly, here in May for Massachusetts. It's been approximately 70 to 75 degrees on average Fahrenheit here.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not sure what the conversion is to Celsius for that, but for us it's amazing. Massachusetts, typically we don't see that here until about June, July. The fact that it's May and we're getting it to be this warm has been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean we're here. I'm in the desert, so it's about 35, 37. Humidity will probably be a bit higher, maybe 40. So you're looking at over. Maybe close to 100 or... No, close to 100. Close to 100. Yeah. So by the time we're looking at... In the next couple of weeks, it will start to ramp up from 40s into 50... Maybe it'll hit 50 by June. So you're looking at 100, maybe 100 and... I think that's 130, 40. I'm not sure what they're thinking. But like I say, it is extremely hot. There's a World Cup here next year. The Football World Cup's here next year. So obviously it's not going to be in that heat. It's going to be they're doing all stadiums up for it and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it's a complete contrast, like you say, to Massachusetts. So let's tell listeners about Massachusetts. Where is it? Where is it on the map in terms of America? Where is it located? And what's it like to live there?
Absolutely. So Massachusetts is in a region called New England of the United States, which is the furthest northeast part of the country.
Yeah.
Massachusetts itself is a smaller state. It's not very large. We're neighbored by New York, which is massive.
Yeah.
But Massachusetts, I've grown up here. I lived here my entire life. I grew up in the part of the state not many people know about. Most people think of Boston when they think of Massachusetts, of course, our capital.
Boston Celtics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Celtics. We of course the New England Patriots American football.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Boston Red Sox, one of the first baseball teams in the United States. If you're a hockey follower, we have the Bruins. If you follow the soccer, we have the New England Revolution as well.
New England Revolution.
Yeah, funnily enough, we actually at my law firm just did the visa for one of their former players who is now playing minor league soccer instead of the major league. So feels pretty cool too. Actually, I've seen the name in the big lights and I've been able to do some work for them.
Yeah,
so.
yeah, yeah.
But all in all, I will say Massachusetts has a very, very unique demographic. It's a very big melting pot of people, primarily, which is wonderful. A bunch of different cultures. A lot of people think of New York as the big melting pot, but Boston, a lot of people come to Boston for work and from all across the world. You know, it doesn't matter, every continent we see people from. Whether that be, you know, Asia, Africa, South America, obviously North America, anywhere across the world, Europe, of course, we have a lot of people come to get into the tech fields in Boston. So it's a very unique experience to live here. And it's lovely. And the state differs so much from the western part to the eastern part. Very mountainous in the west where I grew up. But the east, it's completely flat out near the ocean.
I can understand why the temperatures are quite thin, because you said it's quite near New York, and New York is, gets chilly, doesn't it? It gets really, I'm thinking that, New York, it gets lots of snow and it's cold, you know, and in Chicago, windy city, then it comes down, to New York, and
absolutely.
And I spoke to some, actually, I think I'm sure it was the last podcast, I spoke to someone, I don't think I've uploaded it yet, but I'm sure she said, she's from, because I mentioned New England Patriots, because that's, I mentioned that because she said that I'm sure she said she was from that area, and she said she'd moved down there, and I said, as a child, I had a top. My mum bought a top, there was two tops, I can't remember what the other one was, but mine was New England Patriots. So I always, and then I thought, what's this? And I've always associated it as, you know, the team to follow, in a sense. I don't really follow it as much now, but you know, you tend to have an affiliation to something where you may have a jersey to it or something like that. So what,
absolutely,
you said it's quite it's a melting pot, you know, is it? You said you lived in, you say the north, was it, where it's quite rural, in the where you live now, is it quite a busy place, is it quiet, is it?
Yes, so I grew up in the smallest area of Massachusetts population-wise. For example, my high school was grades 7 through 12, and it comprised of 450 people. That was it for the entire school, and it took nine towns to make one school. So very, very small. Our graduating class was 76 people. It was tiny, which is quite amazing. You get to know your classmates very well. But where I live now is still rural, but it's of course a higher population. It's about 5,000 people in the town I currently live in, compared to the 250 of the town I grew up in. So 250 people only in the entire township, which is amazingly small. But then where I work in Framingham, of course, is closer to Boston, so population's rising, and it's quite busy down there. It's a big business area of the state. And I like where I am, because I like being able to take 5 minutes to go to the store, but you know, be far enough pulled away from the bustle of the city.
Because when you've grown up, you know, like in an area which is quite rural, it's not, and then you go to city. City life maybe can be attractive to a certain point, but then you always want to go back to your kind of creature comforts.
Absolutely, 100%. And that's why I kind of found a nice middle ground with the apartment I'm in today. So
And how's life been this last year, with regards to, again, you know, the pandemic, you know, and what's been happening? What's it been like for you? Before we kind of talk about your journey and stuff, what's it been like for you this last year?
The last year has been quite the journey. I graduated from university in December of 2019, right before the pandemic all broke out. Especially in the United States, we had our first cases back in November 2019. But I graduated from university, and I jumped immediately into a job. I worked as a personal care attendant services coordinator, which, in long story short, I worked for one of the government agencies as a contractor called MassHealth, in which I helped supply services and state services to people with disabilities in the state, and people with either being mental disabilities, physical disabilities, aging individuals, help supply to them services that they could utilize to help them from their day-to-day activities. But it was quite incredible. When I first started that, everything was still regular here in the U.S. I still worked in the office. Nobody wore masks or anything at that point, of course. And it was quite amazing. In March, we had the big turnaround, and everything got told for us because we had to start working from home. We normally would go and talk to our clients, the people requiring services in person, have them sign the paperwork and all of that. But of course, we couldn't do that anymore. We couldn't go house to house anymore. So there was a little bit of a disconnect between us and our clients. A lot of people having a hard time understanding the process, going over everything on the phone or via Zoom call or anything like that was very foreign to a lot of people at first. And I ended up sticking it out there for until October. I was at that job. And then I immediately hopped right into the position I am now at the immigration law firm. But over the year, the pandemic has been, it's been tricky, as we know, for everyone across the world. It's been, we haven't really seen much like this before. If for nothing else, just the massive amount of restrictions here in the States.
So you were able to work through it then? You were able to work through for the last year then?
Yes, quite fortunately, I did not end up losing my job. I was able to keep my job throughout the entire process. My partner, Peyton, ended up losing her job. She worked in retail. And she ended up being laid off for the duration. But then she went back to school, and she's been doing school online ever since. Fortunately, I was very lucky. I didn't lose my job.
How did that affect your partner and your relationship in terms of, the losing? You know, was there fear there? What was going through your minds for the last? I mean, you're working, but there's a change. Like you say, everything's going on Zoom. You know, how did it impact you? And
absolutely. So the big change, I would say, we had been living together at that point for about 2 months when everything happened. So her school switched to online. When she lost her job, she was a working student, so she worked and went to school, lost her job. All of her schooling switched to online. And there was, to be honest, this is my advice. If you could live with your partner throughout this pandemic, seeing each other day to day, especially with both of you working from home, you can make it through anything with that person. That's 7 days a week, 24/7, all the time. So, and there were strains on our relationship at some points in time. That's is the nature of seeing the same person 24 hours a day, like I mentioned, every single day. But all in all, we made it through it. We're a lot stronger for it now. She's doing fine. She's about to finish university in this upcoming winter. So she was been good. All in all, things ended up being okay. I know there's a lot of my friends who had a different experience than I did, but fortunately I paid for our apartment myself. I didn't end up having any sort of financial strain from that or anything, which was I feel very fortunate for.
Definitely. And I was gonna say to you, in terms of you said you went from, so you're quite fortunate, really. So I say fortunate, but it's what you deserve. And you say fortunate, but yes, you're fortunate in terms of the fact that you didn't lose your job. But you went from one job into another, and you, in terms of wearing masks and things like that, what's it been like for? Because I saw something the other day where it said they're now not going to be wearing, you don't have to wear masks in certain places. I mean, what's that change been like for you guys? Or are you going to still wear a mask? Or
yes, so very interestingly, the federal government here in the United States, they lifted their mask mandate as of, it was a couple days ago. The CDC officially said that it's no longer required for anyone who had been vaccinated fully at that point in time and then done their waiting period and all of that. Here in Massachusetts, we still have our state mask mandate in effect. So unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, depending as to who you talk to, it's either a good thing or not. It's the whole math thing has been very interesting. You know, one of the things going through school as criminal justice that we've learned is there's a certain level of trust that you gain from somebody from seeing their entire face and being able to read them and all of that. And it's been very, very difficult. And one of the big concerns I had about the whole mask thing is, well, are we going to see crime rates go up? Are we going to see a lot more robberies getting away with? Are we going to see a lot more people not being able to get caught for crimes simply because the majority of their face is covered now? And we did see, unfortunately, a bit of a rise of that here in the States throughout the pandemic of specifically violent crime and robberies had surged during this period for various reasons, whether it be, you know, more concealment or anything along those lines. You know, people not really, and the other things too, not being able to really associate with your fellow man or woman, you know, being able to read them and understand what they're feeling behind this mask, it becomes a lot more difficult. I've experienced that a lot at work myself. I've learned that I have to retrain how I look and talk to people now that the masks are going to be going away here. You know, make sure that I'm not expressing an emotion on my face of like displeasure or anything like that when I'm having a conversation that I'm trying to get out of or anything like that. So
there's two things there you picked up on. Time goes so quick, and yesterday's news is old news, and I thought, gosh, yes, it would have started in 2019, and then the whole thing kicked off for the world in 2020, for March 2020. So that's old news becomes, like you said, the expressions of the face with a mask. You almost have to, like you say, train yourself. In fact, you've got to get expressions of the eyes then. It becomes another psychological thing where you have to look at expressions of the eyes.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about your journey. We're talking about mental health because the reason why I brought up the last year. Okay, in fact, one more thing. I know that where I live, we don't have, and even in, I say, in the UK to a certain, it's not on the level of America. It's not on the level of, I'm talking about the presidency and the race and the race presidency and just all the things. I mean, last year seemed like a massive year in terms of American culture thrown at the world. I'm not saying that the pandemic thing, but I'm talking about the whole thing. We had the virus, and then people in America talking about the presidency. But we don't get enough of that here. We don't get a lot of that here in Qatar because there's not enough. There's not the type of news outlets, and I don't watch the news. The majority of things I was getting was off Twitter or Instagram or whatever it may be from here. UK, probably a bit more because they have a news outlet that's on 24/7, constantly rotate. So in America, there seems to be a big draw towards this, the presidency candidates and all that sort of stuff, and a lot of money put into the what do you call that process? You know, when they go campaign, American campaigns, a lot of millions put into it. And so then you had the things to do with George Floyd and all those things. In terms of how you saw that last year in that sense, what did it mean to you?
So for me personally, we'll take it. We'll start with the presidency and then move on to the George Floyd situation. Yeah. They are relatively related, surprisingly, in a way here in the U.S. I will be honest, fortunately, I'm still a relatively new voter here in the States. As I mentioned, I'm 24, so I've only voted in this most recent election and the one prior as well. But it's quite amazing. And unfortunately, due to... It really started back in 2016. That all kind of pushed forward here into 2020. When Donald Trump won the election in 2016 here in the States, it was kind of a large turning point from my perspective of how the United States began viewing politics. It was like a cultural change that had happened. Things became a lot more about, if you do not agree with your party lines, if you do not follow your party lines, then you are the bad guy. Or you go to, for example, Massachusetts is a very democratic liberal state, right, here, in opposition to the Republican conservative ideology. And here, during that time period, it's almost like if you were to be in a state such as Massachusetts, or on the other hand, for example, down in like Louisiana, which is very Republican conservative.
Yeah.
If you were to speak against, say, anything against the population that was in favor of one party or the other, you'd be demonized. If I here in Massachusetts were to go to Boston and say I was a Republican, I supported Republican ideology, you'd be chastised horribly.
Okay.
You know, people, you know, even go as far as getting right up in your face, screaming at you, people getting violent even over it.
Wow.
Over a simple difference of ideology. Unfortunately, 2020, it just seemed to get worse during that, whether it be a combination of things. But unfortunately, we did see that, unfortunately, it comes from the top, between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, our current president. How they debated against each other was absolutely dreadful, in my personal opinion.
Yeah.
It was no longer about who can do the best for the country, who can present, the most benefit for the people who they're representing. It became more about who can call the other person the worst name, who can undermine the other person more. It was quite disgusting to watch, personally. Being somebody that loved learning about the United States government and our history and everything, it came from the criminal justice system. Everything became politicized. Even something like the pandemic became politicized here in the States, which is the worst possible thing to happen. So, from my perspective, the elections in 2020 did nothing but drive a further wedge in the society of the United States. More separation, less of a unified America, a lot more of subdivision among the people.
Right.
You know, especially between party lines. Even now to this day, it's horrible between the people. To be honest with you. George Floyd was a horrible situation. Moving on to that, the Minneapolis Police Department should be absolutely ashamed of themselves for allowing an officer that had multiple disciplinary actions against him for racism to continue to be an officer before the George Floyd thing even happened. Absolutely abhorrent that they let him keep his position. And the whole case with Mr. Floyd was awful too. You had the elder officer there, the senior officer, that was basically throwing his weight around about these young trainees that he had with him, killing a man for no other reason than he wanted to throw his weight around. Really, at the end of the day, is how I saw that. And it was awful. It's a truly, truly terrible thing. And just like I said, it did more to drive that wedge in the United States, different societies, especially against the police force. And my family, I went to school for criminal justice. My brother was a police officer up in Maine, the state of Maine, for a few years while he was attending university as well.
Yeah.
And I'm a big supporter of our police departments. But unfortunately, it's like it is. A few bad apples really does sour the bunch. And now here in the U.S., there's just so much police hatred. There's just so much. Everybody, just because they're wearing that uniform, is now classified as a racist or a terrible person, a murderer. And it's quite, in my opinion, quite awful to stereotype any group like that under the actions of a few. So
it's interesting to get your point, because like you say, you've grown up in that system, and it's hard to. And the reason why I asked as well is because it's hard to fathom living in a place where, how can I put it? I'm not in America. I've been to America. I've worked there, in New York and New Jersey. But I haven't lived there long enough, do you know what I mean, to kind of understand what these things mean. Do you know what I mean? The presidential election and, I don't understand what. Yes, I know there's two parties or whatever, just like there is in UK, but we don't have that. It's not on that scale of America where there's like you said, now it's become about hatred for one another and people don't want to vote and all that. I mean, I know people don't want to vote anyway, but I mean, there's, you know, there's probably on a larger scale in America where people just, you know, even probably this last election, probably no one wants to vote for either of them. And it's just the lesser of two evils, in a sense. So it's just interesting to get your point, even about the, you know, the George Floyd thing and the racism. Do you think it's drove a wedge, but do you think it's done a lot to open to question things? Do you know what I mean? See, on that level, question the presidency, question the elections, question who's running our country, question the police, question everything.
Absolutely, and I think that is a good thing that has come out of all this is society's willingness to kind of open their eyes and ask the questions that need to be asked. Holding people more accountable too is something that unfortunately the George Floyd situation did kind of, I think, open the eyes to a lot of American people, and if nothing else, the police departments across the United States really opening their eyes and saying, listen, this action is not tolerated. We're not going to hide. We're not going to hide people anymore. We're not going to hide our officers. We're going to put them out there. And if they're acting in a way that is inappropriate, then they will pay for it. And now society agrees with that kind of terminology here in the States. That first off, racism should not be tolerated anywhere in any division whatsoever. Especially amongst our government officials, such as our police officers, politicians. Everything along those lines.
Yeah. I was gonna say as well, again, based on the fact that, you know, coming even from when I was younger, I remember being driving through and being, you know, stopped by six police officers all armed, and they stopped me asking me for, you know, and I didn't feel, maybe I don't know my personality or whatever, it could be my person, whatever, but I know that if that was a situation in America, I'd probably feel less nervous. I wasn't as nervous because it's not that culture of guns or trigger happy or whatever it may be you want to call it. Whereas, in a sense, in America, you're kind of faced with that on a, do you know what I mean? On a daily basis, someone's carrying something, or the police are, you know, because I've got a friend who's a police officer in the UK, and he had to go to America to train. And when he was training in the firearms and watching them, and he said that in the UK, how they do the police training is that they go to defuse. It's always to defuse the situation first. It's always first. That's the first thinking. They don't think about pulling any sort of taser or guns or whatever. Their first thing is to let defuse the situation, and then whereas. He was saying that the police officer would actually be going thinking armed and thinking that this person will have, you've got to be going thinking that this person could be armed or something. And then that leads to a series of events or whatever. Obviously some of the events aren't excusable, but that's what he was saying. Imagine going thinking that. And I read somewhere that they have to become from zero to holding a firearm. It's like 6 months or something in America, training or something like that.
Yes, so there's a big probationary period where you have to ride tandem with a fellow officer before you're allowed to go off on your own to get the full responsibilities of an officer. There's a large probationary period with that, and you are right. The big issue that I have seen both firsthand and through schooling and experience from other officers too that I've talked to personally, there's a big problem with the training of officers in the United States. Very much stemmed from a more of a military type mindset, training like soldiers instead of like peacekeepers. It's honestly, that's, if you want to find the root of the problem with police in the United States, you got to look at the training. They've been trained for so long to basically treat every civilian that they stop, they pull over, whatever situation it is, like they're there, they could kill you at a second. That is what they're trained from the get-go. And on one hand, I see why they do that. I do. Here in the United States, like I said, there is a mass hatred of police at the moment. So people are more apt to just kill an officer now more than ever, which would be horrible. But more training towards defusing, kind of like you were mentioning in the UK. Definitely could do more with that, because it is taught here, but I feel like the focus isn't quite as high in it as it should be.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked about that. Let's talk about your journey, and you know the reason why I brought those things is obviously thinking about our health, our mental health, and what triggers us. So it's just, you know, that's my pun there for the podcast. Just your kind of journey, your thoughts on mental health and the stigma that surrounds it.
Absolutely. Mental health being, I feel very fortunate that I did get to work with people, with a lot of individuals that had mental health issues here in the United States, specifically here in Massachusetts with my first job. And I think one of the things that often gets overlooked, and I saw it a lot with the clients that I dealt with at my first job, was that a lot of times people are very quick to write off individuals with mental health issues or disabilities at all.
Yeah.
They're very quick to try to basically over pamper them, I guess would be the best way to put it. Kind of write off the fact that they are still a capable individual. They are still able to, process here in the United States. They're able to live a mostly normal life. Most people that I dealt with were. Unfortunately, I think the stigma that our society currently has on individuals with mental health is still lacking in the States.
Yeah.
We still are kind of looking at them as almost second-rate citizens, or treating them with almost an over amount of sympathy, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, I've worked personally with individuals that have, a form of mental disability, or they had you're born with a birth defect, such as like Down syndrome. And they're some of the most brilliant people I've ever met.
Yeah.
Incredibly, incredibly intelligent and capable, but a lot of people want to baby them, basically, no other way to put it. And that doesn't do anything to help their confidence. Of course, you know, give them the support. Absolutely. You got to absolutely support everybody with mental health issues. A lot of people, everybody wants to have a form of independence too, I suppose, is the best way to put it. So,
yeah. So what is it about you that wants to, because I always want to know, in a sense, the job you've done or you want to do is helping people. And what is it about you that makes you want to help people, rather than somebody who's in a completely different situation that might not want to help people? What is it about you? What is it about you as a child? You know, is it something that you've always wanted to do? Have you always been a helper?
I very much do like to help people. It's the reason I have my podcast. For example, I do On the Beat, which is a criminal justice history podcast, and the reason why I wrote that was actually primarily for college students. I wanted to kind of put out there the information that they had to know if somebody else is going through a criminal justice degree program, for example, or somebody else just wanting to know more about what their rights are here in the United States to better protect themselves. I that's the reason why I do that. It's kind of like you. I don't do this for clout. I don't do this for any other reason than I want to help people. I want people to be educated. As far as when I was younger, I was always willing to lend a hand if necessary, but I was really going into life thinking, I want to change the world for the better. I wasn't really that kind of mindset. It was more a day by day, never really put that much thought ahead into my future or anything like that. Just like a lot of other kids here in the United States, I want to be a professional sports player or a rock star or something. Celebrity type character, like a lot of people here.
The Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't in the cards. That wasn't in the cards for me. I did university as a theater major for a year and a half at my first university I went to. Decided that path wasn't for me. But really, I had a big turnaround. Really, after I had dropped out of school for a semester after my first university, I took some time off. I worked as a server at Outback Restaurants. I really realized that, I wanted to do criminal justice. I wanted to do something where I saw all this this corruption that was happening in the States, and I wanted to be like, well, how do I do something about this as an individual? And so I was like, you know, I'm gonna go to school for criminal justice. I don't know what I'm going to do with this, whether it's being an officer or it's, you know, going into the legal system as in the court system or the correctional system. I didn't know what at that exact point in time, but I saw it was an area that was severely lacking in terms of modernization here in the United States. And I really saw that as my avenue to get in there and help. I actually didn't end up doing that until my current job, but I worked as a teacher's assistant at my third university, to help students along, do free tutoring, things like that, to the students that were the underclassmen that were younger than me. Really helped them through the schooling system. And then with my first job, really opened my eyes to, you know, how lucky I am to be who I am. I am an individual that doesn't have any mental or physical disabilities. You know, I feel very fortunate to be as healthy as I am. I really saw that a lot with my first job, helping people out with their services and getting them what they needed. And of course, I just felt grateful, and I felt very happy to be where I was at. And then now working with immigration law, it feels really nice. We're actually, with my law firm, we're up to 1,700 people that have been given permits to work here in the United States this year alone.
See, this is what I'm getting at, you see, because you've spoke about several different things there, and you said it came from somewhere, or it just wasn't thinking, yeah, you want to be a rock star, and you know. but you see what I mean? It's got to be something in you that, you know, yes, you might not have wanted, but what is it? It must have been something from your childhood that mean, you know, you might have helped out somewhere or something, but there's something that's triggered you wanting to, because you've spoke about several jobs there, and all of them have been, even the one to do with the university, it's been about helping people. So as a child, were you a person that, you know, were you kind of, what kind of child were you as growing up?
I was an athlete growing up. My father coached baseball here, so I throughout my elementary school, I played baseball in the spring and football, American football in the fall, all throughout growing up. So sportsmanship and teamsmanship has always been very big. Being part of something bigger than yourself has always been instilled. My father was in the United States Coast Guard, so always that emphasis of being part of a team was really important.
That's part of where it's, I'm going to say this. Now we're getting to the crux of it. You see, that's part of it. You kind of said something there, and sometimes it's just little things, that ethos or whatever it is, something that given to us by our parent, or and then we start to, like you say, working as a team. You don't become, and because even baseball can be a sort of an individual sport, can't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, carry on. I'm just working. The cogs are working now.
Some of the cobwebs in the back parts of my mind, I haven't thought about a while, are getting dusted off here. So I come to think of it, I do remember being in, I must have been grade three, or two or three. So young guy, and we had a student come to our elementary school, from, I don't even remember where he was from, somewhere else in the state. He moved here, and he came in, and the child, he was a menace, absolute menace of a child. He came in, bullied from the get-go, didn't want to be anybody's friend, always harassing people, calling them names, things along those, just nasty things as kids do. I remember the first point of me being like, well, kind of have to like the first injustice standing up to, I guess, kind of idea was to this bully that had moved in. He came in, and a lot of us, you know, our teachers are being very sympathetic towards him. You know, he's new, maybe he's just trying to get along, things like but I remember there was a girl in my class that I grew up with, was very close with at the time, who was allergic to peanut butter. And there was one day we were at the lunchroom, and they always offered peanut butter sandwiches as an alternative to the school lunch. And he took his and he shoved it right in her face. this girl that's deathly allergic to peanut butter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I decided at that point in time, it hit my mind, that can't stand. I don't care at this point. You know, maybe I don't care if he's having a hard time or not. That is unacceptable.
Yeah,
you know, he could kill her
this
by doing this.
Yeah,
exactly. And at that point, a bunch of the boys and I gathered up and we confronted this new kid and we told him basically, you need to stop this completely right now.
Yeah.
Or there will be consequences, as young boys do, you know, as you mentioned, sometimes they're a little bit slower to develop than, you know, so we have a little bit more of that primalness about young boys.
Yeah.
We mentioned it to him. He didn't stop. One of the students in my class ended up giving him quite a black eye. It wasn't me, but one of my buddies there ended up doing that just to kind of draw the line, and he ended up moving away a week later to a different school. Clearly the child had was a menace of some sort. Something going on in his past. But I remember that being the first time where I was like, you know, I need to stand up, I need to do the right thing.
Justice,
here. You know, this is
justice.
Absolutely. But yeah, I think between that probably and then the teamsmanship, just my entire life growing up, you know, doing sports, especially football, American football. I worked on the line, so I was one of five guys that was defending our quarterback or our running back, whoever may have the ball at the time. And that just requires a massive amount of communication and teamwork. So, because I'm a bigger guy. So,
I can't see from here, but
I'm 6'1" and about 210 pounds, so I'm a relatively larger guy.
I can't tell you don't seem like a big guy at all. You seem like me, minute. So you kind of had a role model there in your dad.
Yes, absolutely.
Who gave you and he would have, did he instill a lot of the things that you now recollect and kind of might, maybe, because sometimes when we grow up, we think about the times when our parents chastise us, or we don't think about them at all sometimes, and then it's not until we do something, maybe in the house, and we hear our parents' voices come back to, do you know what I mean? You know, you're laughing.
Absolutely. My older brother always, he nicknames me Dwayne Jr. My father's name is Dwayne, and he calls me Dwayne Jr. all the time, because as I've gotten older, I've developed a lot of the mannerisms that he has. I am very grateful for a lot of things he taught me. You know, a lot like you were saying, growing up, you may get these harsher lessons, you know, that you're taught by your parents. But at the end of the day, sometimes, for me, at least, my father is a very good man. He's done nothing but, you know, be a benefit to his community, and, you know, he served in our military. He's a wonderful family man. So I feel very fortunate for that. But a lot of the life lessons he's taught me, I still implement to this day. Respect being honestly the biggest one of them. Not just for authoritative figures, but for your fellow man as well. Everybody's the same. We all have the same stuff inside us. You know, it's very much respect for your fellow man as well as authority. And I think that's one of the big driving factors for me today and how I view the world. You know, big fan of, obviously, of equality in its truest form. And we are, you know, at the end of the day, all people. And that's how we got to look at it. Yeah. So
why didn't you follow his path into the, or was that something that you didn't want to do? Was you on your kind of... Why didn't you follow his path into like the military and things like that? What changed it for you?
So actually, I was before I attended my third university, I had got my associate's degree. I was considering criminal justice, and I had talked to my parents about that. You know, what should I do? I have my associate's degree.
Yeah.
Should I continue my schooling? Should I do something else with it? Should I just go straight to work? And my father, I said, well, why not the Coast Guard? Why don't you look into that? You know, it's in terms of the military branches here in the States, it's relatively safe. You know, it gives you structure. It gives you veteran status here, which is a huge benefit for a lot of things in the United States.
Yeah.
And so I did, actually. I went to the recruiter. I did my paperwork. I turned everything into I needed. I was a pen stroke away from signing up for 4 years in the United States Coast Guard. But before I did that, I brought the paperwork home with me. I sat there, I stared at it for hours, and thinking, you know, if I sign this paper and turn this in, this is 4 years that I am basically owned by the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to my parents, and they're like, well, you know, once you do this, there's no going back. This is how it is. They're like, are you sure you don't want to do anything else before you do this? And I was like, well, you know, I do want to finish all I have credits left even after my associate's degree in university. You know, yeah. Maybe I should look into that. And I did. I ended up in an amazing stroke of luck. 3 weeks prior to semester's beginning, I contacted Liberty University, which is down in Lynchburg, Virginia, where we were living at the time. We were living in Virginia at the time. I contacted them to see if I could get in, and I got in. I got accepted. So I ended up attending university and said, you know, if I still want to pursue this Coast Guard thing after I'm done, you know, I can still go back and do that after I finish my education.
Yeah.
Obviously, that didn't end up happening. I never ended up joining the Coast Guard, but I was actually, funnily enough, a pen stroke away from signing up.
Yeah. I mean, in that situation there as well, if there's ever a doubt, you just don't go with it.
Absolutely. And that's the huge thing about the military that my dad really pushed on me. He's like, you know, you got to be really sure this is what you want, because there is no getting out of it. You're in it for 4 years minimum here. So
yeah. And you spoke about there was a point you said at one of the universities that you dropped out. What happened there?
Yes, so I attended a year and a half at Longwood, which was a state university in Virginia.
Yeah.
And I was a theater major. I was quite rambunctious at that point, being a freshman away from home, really, first time.
Yeah.
Quite rambunctious. Got myself into some trouble, to be honest with you, with the law. I really took a step back, and I really started to think about my life and what I was doing, and you know, in a way, getting in trouble with the law and dropping out of school the first time was probably the biggest life twist in the best possible way. At the time, it didn't feel like that, you know, when you have an officer reading you Miranda rights, it's quite terrifying.
That's what I want to get at. You see, that's the thing. There is there must be a even at your young age, there must have been a life change, a turn of event, or a light bulb moment, or something which triggered you into back onto your kind of path that you're on now. I'm not going to ask you what you're arrested for or anything, but in terms of you being arrested or caught or whatever, what was going through your mind?
Sure. It was totally unexpected, to be honest with you. I'm totally open about all this, I'm more than happy to share.
Yeah.
You know, my past is my past, and I am still proud, very proud of who I am today. Yeah. So, I used to smoke a lot of marijuana.
Yeah.
And we ended up just wrapping up a very big exam, about the midway exams for one of our classes. Very, very stressful. Big history exam that was worth about 40% of our grade, so very stressful. Me and a couple of my college colleagues, to celebrate, we finished up. We went to our normal spot to smoke, and we did. We got back, everything was quite normal, and then the next thing I knew, my roommate took off, just sprinted out of our apartment, ended up leaving, and me and my other friend were like, well, that was quite odd. You know, maybe we should check in. We texted him to see if he was okay, and never got a reply. And about 15 minutes later, the campus police department showed up at my door. They're like, you know, we have reason to believe that, you know, you're in possession of marijuana, which is illegal in the state of Virginia. And on top of that, I was underage regardless. They came in, and I said, yep, I was shaking in my boots. I knew at that point I was in campus owned apartment, so they could search wherever they'd like, regardless of what I want told them. So I admitted to everything. I said, yes, you know, I do. I gave them everything I had. which wasn't much. Of course, I was a college student. I was poor. I couldn't afford very much.
It's not like you were growing a forest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I turned over, my pipe and just the tiniest bag of marijuana that I had. I gave it to them. Complied with everything they said. They did a full, and it was almost a little bit insulting in a way. I know they were just following protocol, but they ended up. I gave them everything, and they still ended up digging through my entire bedroom apartment, pulling up the mattress. Worst of all, in my opinion, I'm a musician too. They opened my guitar case and they took my guitar and flipped it out and started shaking it violently.
Right, yeah.
And I was just like, please, like this is like one of the things I cherish most in life. Like, please don't break my instrument.
Yeah.
And they came back and they read me my Miranda rights. Now, fortunately, I was obviously shaking my boots, teary eyed and all of that, terrified of what the future was going to hold. And the officer, I never ended up being brought to the station or anything. He just wrote me up a summons right there on the spot to appear in court. And he said, I'm not going to bring you to the station. I'm not going to handcuff you. Just so you know that, basically what's happening, you need to appear in court this day, follow the whole procedure.
Right.
And I later ended up finding out, and this is the worst part of all of it for me, was that what ended up happening is my roommate, when he sprinted out, ended up reporting everything to the police department. And he was someone I considered my closest friend at the time,
right,
in university. So basically he turned me into the police department. I still don't know to this day why he did it. I asked him and he just kind of ignored it, blew it off. It was a very troubling time, and I went through. So I do have the lucky perspective that I have been on both sides of the law. I've seen both the enforcement and the punishment side of it.
Yeah.
But it was a long, very arduous process. Very expensive. At the end of it, I ended up spending between mandatory drug rehabilitation classes, which, in my opinion, were completely absurd to even be having.
Yeah.
Between that and the paying off of the state, and then in Virginia, you lose your license for 6 months if you get caught with marijuana. So,
right.
Or you did before they legalized. Yeah. They legalized it now.
Legalize it now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, after all this is when it all gets legalized.
Yeah.
But,
after incarcerating many, 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 many people, all of a sudden they legalize it. So it's crazy. Yeah.
It is. It's absolutely incredible. And, I still feel to this day that even with all the penalties I paid to the court, I mandatory, losing my driving ability for 6 months, all of this, I still feel very fortunate, because that could have gone so much worse. They officer even told me, he's like, since you were smoking with your friends, we could have hit you with drug distribution, which is a mandatory 5-year sentence in state, or used to be 5-year sentence in penitentiary.
Oh my.
So for just trying to smoke with my friends and have a fine time. I wasn't selling drugs. I wasn't a drug dealer or anything like that. But just because I was sharing with my friends, officer threatened me with that if I didn't comply. So.
Wow. I've got to this age, and it's now I'm starting to realize, I've known that there's harsh penalties in, penalties in America for doing some of the, I shake my head sometimes. I hear some of the things like jaywalking and things like that. You could be arrested for it. It just blows my mind. I saw a video the other day, and it was a guy riding a bike. It was on Instagram. A guy was riding a bike, and it must have jaywalked, or what you call it, going across traffic lights, whatever you call that, jaywalking. And these two officers came, and they didn't even stop him. They actually grabbed him and pinned him down to the ground. I was thinking, what for jaywalking? And like you said there, he could have given you the fact that it could be distribution, and you could have ended up in prison.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel very fortunate. I'm still very grateful to the magistrate that heard my case that day, because he told me, he said, I'll always remember this. While I was at the hearing, he said to me, he goes, I'm going to give you the absolute minimum that I can. You have been nothing but respectful. You were respectful to the officers. You turned in everything. They, you know, you weren't hiding anything. He's like, you were a college student. He's like, are you still attending university? And I said, no, I had to drop out. This has gotten too expensive for me. I need to worry about things other than that, making money so I could pay off these court fees and all of this. And he ended up telling me, and he, prior to giving me my sentence, he said, you're a good person. I can see that. And I'm not going to sentence a good person to prison. He's like, I will not do that. He goes, made a mistake. He's like, I am not going to punish you for a mistake because I've made plenty in my life too. And he's like, so I'm going to give you the bare minimum I can, which was still extreme in the state of Virginia, but it didn't involve any jail or prison time whatsoever. It was just the fine, the minimum fine, minimum community service, and the losing of my license for 6 months. So I feel very grateful to the judge for that.
So based on the fact that you were smoking, and there was a little bit, like you said, there was a little bit in the thing here, there was a possibility that you could have, you in a sense then, you were facing the prospect of jail.
Absolutely.
I'm stunned.
I'm
absolutely stunned.
This is the United States in a nutshell here, and you know it's still like that for and really when we, this is the big push that I had, maybe without even knowing it, with my experience of this is, and where I still stand to this day, is you shouldn't be treating people who are using drugs as criminals. That's not the whole perspective of somebody who is, for example, addicted to heroin. You can't treat that as a normal crime. That's, it goes far beyond that. It's not, the owning of a drug is not, you know, it's not like they're out there committing violence.
Yeah, I know.
They're not out there doing this. You know, they're clearly taking this drug because there's something in their life that's driven them to this point.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I was incredibly stressed. It was university. It was very intensive. I was working. On top of that, I was spending a minimum of 40 hours a week in play productions for the theater every week, on top of regular schooling and on top of having a job. I was an incredibly stressed individual, and that's what helped me through it. You know, whether that was the right thing to do or not, that's what I did, and it helped. And the fact that even still in the United States, we treat people that use recreational drugs as criminals and can incarcerate them for most of the time up to 5 years just for using a drug is amazing, absolutely amazing.
So you were the only person that went to, your friend didn't go to court?
No, he was completely innocent, because they didn't even question him. They didn't ask him. The guy that turned me into the police department got off scot-free. They didn't charge him with anything. My other friend who was smoking with us didn't get charged with anything. I was the only one that ended up getting anything against me.
And I'm, dare I say it, is this person that shipped you, is this person still your friend?
Oh Lord, no. I haven't spoken with him in years, to be honest
I just wanted to make sure, like, because that's, I don't know. In fact, when I say shocked, I'm shocked by the fact that you're saying that it could have landed, because I know there's people who've, when I've heard the stories about people being, you know, over the years who have gone to prison for, you know, having marijuana, sometimes it could be intent to supply or whatever, but also it's just, like you said, just for smoking it, and they've gone to prison for smoking smoke. So isn't that something that's causing, if it was something to cause them harm, like heroin, say, for instance, that's going inside their body. And isn't that then becomes their prison in a sense, because they're not harming anybody else, if you see what I mean.
Exactly. I 100% agree with that. That is, that individual, and this is what, unfortunately, the criminal justice system doesn't seem to understand in the United States here. That individual is going through more in their own personal I mean, to be honest, their own personal hell that they're going through right now with their addiction to drugs is far worse than any penalty you could impose on them. So the fact that you're not supporting them in all you're doing is saying we're going to lock you up and take you away from this thing without giving you any treatment for it is absurd. It's you know, what do you think they're going to do as soon as they get out? They're going to go right back to where they were most of the time because you never rehabilitated them. Mm. You just said you broke the law. This is your punishment.
Yeah. I did a podcast show with, I don't know if you've listened to it, Frank Soonius. He's from Holland, and what they did was they did a program. I don't know if you know about this. A few years back they did a program where they administer, it's like a safe places. So people, they've got a drug problem, and they will give the person who's got a drug problem or drug dependency the drug, or a little bit of it, and then that the psychology of that is that it helps them to go to a safe place, but it helps them to wean them off it because they're getting little bits and little bits rather than a large dosage. And then what happens is it's like a massive program in Holland, and so you'd think something like that would be better, but also I know with the justice system there's money in prisons, there's money in the prison system, so that's probably why they do it. And obviously the lead up to that, you said you spent a lot of money.
Yeah, I spent at the end of the day about $2,600. So it's amazing. Yeah, and I was a young man. I didn't have that money to spend. I still to this day don't have that much money to just throw away.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredible, and that was the minimum that I could pay.
Yeah. And I want you to kind of give the listeners out there the feeling that you had, you know, I don't mean every day, I mean right up until the, you know, you're fearing that, you know, is there fear that you might go to jail? Are you, you know, is there a lot of worry? What was the effect like on your mental health? What was the effect like on your family?
Absolutely. For my parents, bless them, they were incredibly supportive, which was a relief in of itself. I took about 10 minutes after we finished with the officers. I looked at my buddy who was just sitting on the couch, like complete slack jawed, like in disbelief of everything that just happened.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I just remember feeling numb. At first, that was the first thing, it was just a blind numbness. Wasn't really emotion attached to it. It was kind of like a form of shock, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Total disbelief of everything that just happened, between the feeling of, you know, dealing with the law and then the betrayal, obviously from my friend at the time. Just a complete another shock to the system. I took about 5 minutes. I went in my room. I turned all the lights off. I just laid in my bed, shut the shades for complete blackness for about 5 minutes. And I just laid there in disbelief until I could finally start regaining emotion back to what I was feeling.
Yeah.
And I picked up my phone and I dialed my parents. I told them all about it and I explained it to them. They heard me out the whole time. They didn't jump at me or anything, trying to, you know, didn't give me any flack or anything like that. They were just like, you know, it sounds like you basically had a really bad situation. You were trying to, you know, just trying to release and let go. You know, maybe we don't quite condone what you were doing for that, but you know, we understand. Which felt was a bit of a relief, to be honest. There was at least one stressor. But then I remember trying to go to sleep that night, and I couldn't. I couldn't go to sleep. It was probably a panic attack, to be honest with you. Heart was pounding, just absolutely pounding in my head, in my ears. I was getting shakes. It was dreadful.
Yeah.
Just the fear of what was to come. You know, not knowing what's going to happen. The fact I could be facing jail time was terrifying. You know, the fact that this one incident could be, you know, a permanent mar on my record, could affect work in the future, could affect any sort of federal aid I might need in the future if I want to keep going to school. Because here in the U.S., if you get caught with a drug charge, or a DUI, then you have the potential to lose all of your federal aid for school.
Wow. Keep talking. I'm just going to turn the light on. Keep talking.
Yeah, lovely. But yeah, that was really the experience that night. I remember just feeling almost like I was dying, to be honest with you. Like my heart was going to give out any second from how hard it was pounding, how fast it was pounding.
Yeah.
It was dreadful. It's one of the worst emotionally, it's probably the worst I've ever felt in my entire life.
Yeah.
It was just, it's a feeling, unless you've been there, unless you've experienced that, it's really hard to grasp what you mean. It's almost like, it feels like you've run a marathon, but your body isn't exhausted, but you feel that pain in your chest. You feel that exhaustion in your head.
Yeah.
You know, you that want to just sleep and make it all go away, but you can't because you're wired wide open. Your body's just going on pure adrenaline.
Yeah.
It's indescribable, and it's a feeling I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. It's absolutely dreadful.
Yeah. Was any sort of like you say, there was dreadful moments. Was any type moments where you felt, you know what, you know what's going to happen to me, or I'm going to, you know, even closer to the court date, was there any times where you thought, like, you know, I'm going to give up, I can't be bothered, or, you know, was it, what went through your mind for those few months?
So I think I had the support of my family, which was a huge part of it. I think.
Yeah.
They kind of helped me throughout whenever I was starting to go to a little bit of a dark place, being really concerned, terrified. I remember, as funny as this is, a couple times thinking, you know, after this is all said and done, I'm going to move to Canada where my record can't follow me, which is ridiculous to think about.
Yeah,
but I do remember that going through my head, being like, I'm just going to run away from this.
You start thinking of alternatives, or you start to look at analyzing, and you think, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to go to hiding in the desert or whatever, yeah.
Exactly. Someplace where they can't find me, you know.
Yeah.
Someplace go far away. I actually, for a while there, because between when I was charged and when my court date was about a month and a half, between the two of them, after a while, the concern became dulled, I guess is the best way to describe it. It dulled down for me, and then it only really sparked up again a couple days before the court appearance, because I knew, at least for that point, nothing was going to happen to me between that point and when my court date.
So there's no point in, yeah.
Exactly. So I tried to do my best to persevere through that without thinking about it, just living day-to-day life, continuing work and all of that, just wrapping up the semester and all that, because that happened back in November, so I was still wrapping up the semester. So I was just finishing school, working, all of that, to try to keep my mind off of it. And then I remember the day where we drove to the court appearance, my parents drove me there. I remember sitting in the back seat and just shaking in my boots the whole way there, just like the kind of that feeling that I had the first night that it happened, started to come back. And I remember feeling all internal and not saying a single word about it, just trying to deal with it myself. And then I walked through the doors of the court, and I was, even though I only waited in the hearing for about 40 minutes or so for my name to be called up, it felt like I was there for hours. It felt like I was sitting in the pews of the church, the pews of the courts for hours. So it was a horrible experience, just the waiting. Even though, like I said, it was only about 40 minutes, but it felt like I was there for hours. And then when I finally went up there, the judge asks, how do you plead? I pleaded guilty. Obviously, they had all the evidence against me. There was no way I was going to plead not guilty in a situation like that. After I got my sentence, I walked out, and I wasn't sure what to feel, because I didn't know really how severe what I was given. And until after, obviously, the judge told me that it was the minimum sentence for the state of Virginia. But up until that point, when he was starting to say everything and, send out know, everything. I didn't know how severe that was in the grand scheme of things. All I know is I was happy I wasn't going to jail. That was that was the one thing I was happy about. I was unsure, but I was like, okay, well, at least I'm not going to prison. So
into interesting with the how can I put it? We have this a system or set of rules or regulations or whatever it may be, and say like in America, where you were made to feel exactly how somebody who may have done a crime, as you say, you know, you would have gone through the same emotion as somebody who's gone through a crime. You know, I can't class that as a crime. You know, you're smoking, you know, as much as they put it as a regulation or whatever, you can't put, that's not a crime. Even if, do you not understand what I mean? You not understand what I mean. But what I'm saying to you is, you, and the time it happened and then leading up, you would have gone through the same emotions as somebody who's committed, I don't know, stole something from the shop, or, do you know what I mean? Or did something which was more of a crime, you know, hit somebody or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, that's kind of like the big thing. I'll always remember that feeling. That is a part of me that I will always remember. That is a memory that has been ingrained, and I still think back to that sometimes. And, you know, it's really silly, and this is absolutely ridiculous to think about, but there are some days where, I'll think about that and be like, is this something that will come back to bite me? Well, there will be, if I get pulled over by a police officer now, will they pull up my record and see, well, he's been charged with marijuana, and say, this is due cause to search my car? Is this something that's going to end up happening now in the future because I have this charge against me, you know? And, you know, in, under more circumstances, they can't do that. They need to have a warrant to search your vehicle and things here in the States now. But it is still a concern of mine that's like, you know, this is something that, one day could come back to bite me again. And it does some days. I do feel anxious about that. Of course, odds are that will never happen. But you know, I feel really bad for the people that have had been in a situation like mine, and the officer wasn't so lenient, and they got taken down to the station for booking, and all of that, and they ended up being, you know, put in a holding cell until their court hearing or their magistrate hearing.
So all those things have, and that's the reason why I was kind of asking you, because when we go through things, and our experiences, it doesn't define us, but it does. It doesn't define us to any. It defines us, might define you at that point of when you've been through something, but after that, when you come through it, when you start to learn and grow through it, and you start, it starts, it trains you, so you will know more about the justice system now, and you will look, maybe even look at other people's, what other people are going through. Like you said, you've now gone on to help people with mental health disabilities and stuff, and you can then maybe even see their side of what they may have got, maybe going through, or what they may have gone through, for those people who have got a dependency now, and they might have gone through a similar thing to you, but then mentally they're broke. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. There's actually when I was attending when I was attending Liberty to get my criminal justice degree, I did some community service at the juvenile detention center in the town of Lynchburg, Virginia, where our school was located. It was a program that was offered to the criminal justice students, and I'll never forget the first time I went in there, and you go through the whole process, you sign your forms, you know, that you aren't like a sex offender or anything like that, all of those forms, so you can go into the place. And they first take you to the detention cell that that these juvenile offenders first go to, and it's tiny. It's a tiny room. It's basically a rectangular, completely cinder blocked, painted completely white room with a single porthole window to the outside. And it has a cot, it has a toilet and a sink, and that's all it is. And they're held there for the first week while they're there, mm-hmm. by themselves, isolated chamber. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, juvenile offenders can be anywhere typically from the age of 8 to 17.
Gosh.
How could I justify an 8-year-old staying in a place like this, no matter what they did, staying in a cell that small, an 8-year-old child?
So you said for eight, a week. You said 8 years old.
8 years old in the States is typically the youngest age somebody can be incarcerated in the States.
Wow. That's another, yep. that's another wild mark. It's like, what the hell? Literally, what the hell?
Yeah, no, it's truly amazing to me. The juvenile now, odds are somebody that young will never be incarcerated, but it has happened. You know, even recently, in the 2000s, it's happened. You know, it's not even that long ago. And a lot of these kids here that I worked with were 11, 12, 13, mm. young guys. You know, Lynchburg, the town of Lynchburg was relatively rough in places, heavy gang violence primarily. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of these kids grew up in gangs. That's the reason they were there, for either selling drugs or for, unfortunately, assault and battery or even murder. There was a few kids that were there for murder too. And I'll never forget, I you know, it's another very memorable experience while I was there. There was this one kid that I spoke to. And I can't disclose his name, you know, he was talking to me and he's like, you know, the reason that I asked him, I was like, you know, why are you here? I like to know your story too. You know, you've heard mine. You know where I'm from. I shared my same story. I told you guys here today, to them, that I was, you know, I'd run in with the law. I've been on that side before. He told me, he's like, you know, the reason I'm here. And I asked him why, and he said, because I killed a guy that was breaking into my house protecting my brother. And guy came in brandishing a knife, tackled his younger brother to the ground, was going to stab him, and the kid shot him, and he was incarcerated for it. And it was amazing to me. I was like, you're seriously here for the defense of your younger brother? He said, yep. And I don't know if this was a factor or not, but he was a young African-American man. Mm. And came from a very impoverished area, I'll never forget him. And I just went home that day thinking to myself, like, how is that justified that a 13-year-old child was incarcerated for murder for defending his younger brother from an adult assailant? How is that just?
Yeah, yeah.
How is that just at all?
Yeah.
13-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. What, you know, your job, what's your job now? You said your job, it's in immigration.
What is? Yes. Yeah. I work as a legal assistant for an immigration law firm.
Okay. So what does your job entail then, in terms of what you do?
So I'm kind of like the handyman of the office. I do pretty much a little bit of everything for all of our legal teams and our operations team.
Right.
So primarily, I do reception, so I answer phone calls and emails, respond to those, and get them to the correct person. Right now, because of the pandemic, I'm doing a lot of petition preparation. So a lot of things of getting people's paperwork together for their work visas or whatever it may be, and submitting that to the federal government for approval. That's the biggest part of my job is the preparation stage of the petitions. And then subsequently sending them out once they're approved after review. You know, obviously, other than that, you know, keeping the office supplied, you know, doing the daily cleaning and stuff with the office. Basically, you know, being a good team player for the rest of the team.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that again is because the way you're speaking, I don't mean the way you're speaking, it's your accent or anything. I'm talking about the way, you know, smiling. I'm talking about the way you're speaking and the words that you're saying. Do you see something more? Do you see this? Put this. Do you see yourself in fact, let me ask you. What do you see for yourself in the next 5-10 years?
So In terms of location-wise, I love where I work at the moment. The firm I work for is yeah. wonderful, absolutely amazing. The management is fantastic. Benefits and pay are quite good. I'm hoping, as long as the cards play right, I will be staying there for the duration. Hopefully, as long as everything keeps playing well. Hopefully to move up the ladder here, get to potentially a director of operations position. I was thinking about going legal, but the only problem is there's only so far I can go without getting, a lawyer's degree, getting a JD or anything along those lines, which in all honesty, I don't really foresee myself doing. I don't foresee myself becoming a lawyer. Hopefully climbing the ladder of operations.
Because what I was just thinking there, because the way you're speaking, you're speaking is to do with justice. And it seems to be there seems to be a theme of, again, helping people, like you say, it could be within that job, getting people, you say immigration status and things like that. And it could be, I don't know if you have cases where, there's a struggle for immigration and, I don't know what it entails. But I'm going to presume that there must be situations where you have where people who have, who want to get in or who want immigration, maybe don't have it and you maybe have to talk or I don't know, but I don't know, to see something within you, there's a thing of justice and you want maybe helping younger people or whatever it may be, because there's obviously you've been through it and now you're on the other side and you're working that system. I don't know what you thought about that. I mean, maybe that's what you're doing in a sense at the moment.
I find my, justice is huge to me. I actually, funnily enough, I'll show you, I've got a tattoo of some scales on my arm for that. So,
scales of justice.
Scales of justice, exactly.
See, I know, I can tell by the way you're speaking, there's something, and that's the reason why I was kind of probing you, there's something there. And even when the bit before you said, just before you said you was in the back of your, back of the car, I knew you were in the back of the car. I felt it. I was actually in the car with you and I could feel me as you in the back of the car looking out and thinking what you're thinking. Even before you said that, which I don't know, I get that. I get into people's stories and I start thinking, picturing myself there. So carry on what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, justice is honestly one of the hugest pillars of my personal belief system. I'm not talking about, and it's not confined to a specific country or state or anything like that. It's the sense of overarching justice for humanity as a whole.
Yeah.
Zero tolerance for injustice and 100% tolerance for things that are right. Immigration law firm, what I love it so much is it feels like what we do is always a good thing. There's no chance where I go to work and I think, for example, in criminal law, I'm not going in there to work for the defense of a known rapist or something like that.
Yeah.
So with my job, I feel very fortunate. I go in and all I'm trying to do throughout my day is trying to get people who want to come to the United States to work, ability to come to the United States and work. It's all a good thing.
Yeah.
So I don't have any question of my moral compass when I go to work every day, whether I'm doing the right thing or not.
Yeah.
It's just always, I know I am. So
yeah. That's a good point, because I actually thought about that earlier as well, about the fact that there's no way you could ever maybe want to be a thing, because the sense of justice is probably be too strong for you to deal with if there was an injustice, if you were a lawyer. You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
No matter how much money you were getting. What would you say to somebody who may be going through what you went through, anxiety, heart palpitations and all these sort of things. And what would you say to somebody who may be struggling at the moment then?
If I were to go back and talk to myself to kind of try to calm myself down, I just have to keep reminding myself, this is temporary. This is a temporary state of being. This is not permanent. This, even though it feels like your world is ending and everything is crumbling around you right now, this is temporary. You will persevere through this. You are strong enough to persevere through this. You have that will to keep going. I know you do, because I've seen you in the future and I know what you do. And I know what you're capable of. And this is just a minor bump in the road. You will get past this.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest thing that I can tell anybody who's going through, not just something maybe with the law, but anything that they're come across that that really throws them for a loop or is a huge life-changing event, is this is temporary. This feeling of anxiety will end. It will eventually end.
Yeah.
And not to say it will never come back, but if you can remind yourself that it may last for a while, but it will be over. You will get out of this.
Yeah.
Then you can make it through anything. And that is the key, in my personal opinion, of human survival, is we can persevere. Humans are very, very adaptable people when it comes to emotions. Actually, tattoo on the other arm is perseverance. So,
yeah, yeah.
actually, that one was, I got that one after relatively recently, kind of as my own self-reminder. When I am going through hard times, I just grab onto my arm and I'm like, you know, I've made it through things that are harder than this, more emotionally tolling than this. I can make it through whatever I'm doing right now.
Yeah. And that almost becomes your kind of comfort blanket, in a sense. You know, the kids have their comfort blanket, that Charlie Brown and all that sort of stuff. It becomes your
absolutely
comfort thing.
Absolutely. I found myself patting my left arm quite a bit when things get going, get tough. So.
Yeah, brilliant. And I'm really glad for your honesty, because, you know, as a man, sometimes we don't reveal things like, or that's our comfort thing or whatever it is, and that's brilliant, and you've got it close. It's part of you, and that you're able to kind of grab hold of it. What do you do to cope? What do you do apart from that? What's your life like? You know, you've got your partner. What things do you like doing? Do you to kind of wind down the day, and do you go for bike rides, exercise? Do you still play football, baseball? What's your thing?
Yeah, so usually every night after we get home from work, we have a lovely park that's about 200 meters away from our apartment. So we always go, we take Peyton and I, we get home, we make a nightly ritual of when I get home, I set my things down before we have dinner.
Yeah.
I get home around 6:15, 6:30 every night. We go for a little walk down to the park, and there's a beautiful river that flows alongside of it, and the sound of the water, actually, it's very soothing to me, that sound of rushing water. I don't know why. Water has always been very, very stress relieving for me. So just listening to that and just kind of closing my eyes and feeling like, you know, all the cares of the world are flowing down that river. You know, the day's over. I can just project whatever bad things I was feeling if I had a relatively bad day.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I've got something I'd rather, you know, not worry about anymore. I just mentally cast them into that river and just let them flow away till the next day.
That's brilliant what you said there about casting things into that river and let it flow away, and kind of let it, you know, because it will dissipate in the water and flow away to wherever. Last thing for me, where can you be found? What's your podcast called? This is your chance to kind of, if you haven't bigged yourself up yet, this is your chance to big yourself up.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. And before I get into that, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been an absolute delight. I'm very, very happy to be here. My show, my name is Noah Blakesley again. I have a show called On the Beat, which is a criminal justice history podcast. You can find it on Spotify, anywhere else podcasts are found, really. You can also follow us on Instagram, same thing, on period, the period beat period podcast, or on Facebook. We have a Facebook page as well.
Yeah.
We go over history of United States criminal justice, different events, whether it be court cases. Primarily, I've been doing a big topic-based thing is what I really revolve around.
Yeah.
So I pick a topic for the week, and I delve into the history of it and where we currently stand into the United States. I try to keep it as non-biased as possible, simply fact. I leave the opinions up to my listeners and what they want to formulate from that. You know, I think that's really, really crucial if you're doing a history-based podcast, is to make it as neutral as possible.
Yeah.
So that's where you can find me. Find me on Instagram is where I'm the most active, probably out of any of them. But yeah, if you're fancying, and the episodes are quite short. Most of them are within 15 minutes. So, you know, it's 5 minutes out of your day most of the time, 5-10 minutes, if you're driving to work or whatever, and want to learn a little bit more about your rights in the United States or the history of a specific topic, just feel free to tune in, and I'll be happy to have you listen.
Yeah, and you seem to be a man of truth, justice. I won't say the American way.
maybe what we hope the American way would be.
Yeah. And just before we go as well, we spoke earlier about V for Vendetta, and I can see him in the back there. Where's that film ranking your? Because obviously V for Vendetta, we're talking about justice and everything like that. Where's that rank in your list of films?
Oh, absolutely top 10. I would say if I were to pick of its type, which is really social commentary type movies, it's got to be one or two. I mean, they're both absolutely amazing to me. Maybe only next to The Truman Show, if you've ever seen that.
Oh, yeah, The Truman Show, of course. Yeah,
yeah, The Truman Show. Yeah, yeah. Which is another wonderful social commentary. Yeah, but yeah. I would say those top two for social commentary movies, just it's absolutely incredible. The idea that, you know, the government's only as powerful as its people, and the people do have the power to come back and fight for justice over the injustice they've suffered is really, really quite spectacular, which is something obviously I stand heavily for, so.
N for Vendetta, Nendetta.
And not only that, it's got like one of the best alliteration scenes of any movie ever.
You talk about the part where he says, I am V. And he goes through the series of V's and V's and V's.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's absolutely incredible. Violent. I give the actor so much props for memorizing all of that. Because being somebody who has an acting background, that is incredibly difficult to do.
And I'd like to say thank you for coming on. And it's been a pleasure. I mean, you've been smiling throughout. I mean, there's parts where we kind of dug a bit deeper, and there's parts, and I like to see people's expressions and thoughts, and I can see where some of the things you kind of went through, turmoil, and then, you know, you're now in a happy place. So I'd like to say thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
And that was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.